This is the BBC Light Programme. News has just come from Buckingham Palace. The Queen has had her baby. It's a boy.
When a joyous moment arrives, most of us imagine it was completely 50-50 as to whether the new member of the family, royal or otherwise, is a son or a daughter. The announcement, by the way, was of Her Majesty's second son, Andrew. But are the numbers of girls to boys in our families really down to the toss of a coin? In fact, it's not quite so simple. For a start, for every 100 girls born, there are 105 boys. But also, you as an individual mother or father might have loaded the dice towards a son or a daughter right back at conception.
There's now amazing evidence that individual parents in a wide variety of species really do sway things and produce sons or daughters depending upon the environmental conditions.
From insects through reptiles to mammals and birds.
In the eclectic parrotis, one female produced 30 sons before producing a single daughter.
Precision family engineering from a parrot, but it's quite possible we humans are doing something similar.
One example is from 19th century Mormons in America, and there is a significant correlation between church rank and the proportion of boys that these men have with their more than one wife. Men higher in the church have more sons.
So do presidents of the United States and women in wartime. As we'll hear, there's even a personality test that can tell an expectant mum what her chances are of a son or a daughter. In humans, though, the biasing of sex ratios is a subtle affair. So the best places to start understanding the whens, whys and hows are in parts of the animal kingdom where the evidence is clearer cut. For example, it's going on in some of our commonest birds.
So we're in the middle of Whiting Woods, which is just on the edge of Oxford. And all around us there are the common British woodland birds and happily getting on with the early stages of their breeding attempts.
This is Ben Sheldon of Oxford University, taking me for a bird-watching ramble in his local study area.
And that's a great tit. Yeah, they're very common here, and there's quite a large number of pairs of blue tits and great tits that are breeding in nest boxes here, and we've been studying those in the Department of Zoology actually for the last 50 or 60 years.
And can they exert control over the sex of their nestling?
Yeah, so there's evidence from both species that the sex ratio of the young is non-random. So in a sense, there are particular characteristics of breeding pairs that will affect the sex ratio that the parents produce.
What's the main factor then? What determines whether parents will go for more boys or more girls?
One of the best studied cases relates to male attractiveness in the blue tit. And the blue tit is a species which, to our eyes, the male and female look fairly similar. But we've known for about 10 years that birds can see in the ultraviolet, and it turns out that males are much more richly coloured in the ultraviolet than females. And males that are relatively very brightly coloured in the ultraviolet, the females that breed with those males produce more male offspring than males that are less brightly coloured.
So why would they go for more male offspring then in that case?
As with lots of animals, males have more variation in how many offspring they can have than females. And in birds, the key to that is that some males, they're able to mate with other females than the one they're pairing with. So some males may be very successful in getting offspring in other nests. And it seems that it's the males that have the brightest ultraviolet coloration that are most successful in that. So if you're a female paired to a male that's got brilliant ultraviolet coloration, and we suspect that that's inherited by the female's sons, then your sons are likely to be very successful compared to those of other males.
So because they too are more likely to get these
extra pair matings later down the line. Yeah. Now, on the other hand, if you're a female mated to a relatively dull-coloured male, then your sons might not be very successful. On the other hand, your daughters may do relatively well. So the idea is that this causes a difference in the expected success of your male and female offspring depending on what colour your male partner is, so how attractive your male partner is. If your male partner's attractive, you would get more through your offspring by producing male offspring than by producing female offspring.
So what sort of biases then do you get in these nests when the eggs come to hatch?
The sort of thing we're talking about is a bias of perhaps 65% males in the nests of the most attractive males and 35% males in the nests of the least attractive males.
From the evolutionary perspective, it's all about trying to maximise your number of grandchildren to get as many of your genes as possible into future generations. In birds, it's not only male beauty that can influence the parents' chances of sons or daughters to achieve this end. In the Seychelles warbler, it's how much food there is around the family property. Dutch ornithologist Jan Comder of the University of Groningen has discovered dramatic manipulations in this small brown bird of the Indian Ocean islands.
Birds on high-quality territories where there's lots of food, they mainly produce daughters. And daughters, they normally stay with the parents and they assist parents in raising a subsequent brood. So by having a daughter, the parents will benefit in the future. However, on low-quality territories, it is not so good having a daughter. So what parents do, they produce male eggs and sons normally disperse. And by having dispersing sons, they avoid having competition over food in the future.
So how much control then do these birds appear to have over deciding whether they're going to have a son or a daughter?
We test that just by translocating birds from low-quality territories. We translocated them to an island where there's lots of good quality territories. We knew they've mainly produced sons before capture, and then we released them on an island where there's lots of good food. They established high-quality territories. And after the translocation, they mainly produced female eggs. About 83% of all the eggs were female. So it seems like they have very good control what bit sex to produce.
What's a mystery is how they and other birds exercise this control. What's almost certain, though, is that it's something the mother bird is doing. Back to the woods with Ben Sheldon.
There is some recent work that suggests that hormone concentrations, so the concentrations of hormones like corticosterone and testosterone, can influence the sex ratio that females produce. So we know that external factors, you know, for example, stress or social interactions, can cause hormonal changes in the individuals. And that might be one way that, you know, a mating could then be linked to the sex of the egg that an individual produces. But there's still a huge amount of work to do.
The idea that parents might evolve the means to cheat the son or daughter lottery to maximise their grandchildren down the line has its conceptual origins with a hypothesis put forward 30 years ago by two American scientists. Stuart West, an evolutionary biologist at Edinburgh University.
The Trivers-Willard hypothesis basically says that under some conditions it will pay to produce a male offspring and under other conditions it will pay to produce a female offspring. And this was sort of originally come up with by Trivers and Willard, thinking in terms of a mammal, something like a red deer, where the mating system leads to a few high-quality males getting all of the matings. So, for example, in deer, you've got a rutting system. The situation that you'd have there is it's only really worth producing a son if you can produce a good, high-quality son. If you're not such a good quality mother, you don't have so much resources to put into your offspring, you might as well produce a daughter. Because even though a lower quality daughter won't do as well as a high quality daughter, she'll still reproduce and do reasonably, whereas sort of low quality son could end up doing pretty abysmally.
From a practical point of view, though, it's turned out to be a real challenge to prove this hypothesis in animals in the real world, particularly in our close relatives, the monkeys. Sarah Erdy of the University of California at Davis.
We really don't know whether this is going to pan out or not. So it remains the wild, wild world of monkey sex research. In fact, years ago when Bob Trivers and Dan Willard first published that 1973 article proposing that mothers might be manipulating sex ratios, Bob told me, he said, you know, even if I'm wrong, it's going to take them years to find out. And it's true. It has. It's been prophetic.
For monkeys, maybe. But the hypothesis has been rigorously tested and proven correct for another mammal at a far-flung location in western Scotland, the Isle of Rum.
Oh, Rumple's over there. She's quite a good one, actually.
Which one's Rumple?
So you've got one scratch in his bottom furthest left on the other side of the wall. She's just
Ellie Donald, introducing some of the 300-odd red deer of Cambridge University's study population. A group of 20 females with some of their youngsters from last year are grazing on a flat expanse of grass, an oasis of green amid the moorland hills and mountains. Ellie knows all of the deer by sight and by name and follows their lives and fortunes year after year.
We know all the animals, who's who and who is related to who, back from the early 70s.
The study on rum has taught us quite a bit about the birth-sex ratios. It's possible to follow individuals through their lifespans and not only to see how many male and how many female offspring different individuals produce, but also to look at the effects of the parents' characteristics, the parents' age, the parents' dominance, on the eventual reproductive success of their offspring.
Tim Clutton-Brock, who heads the Rum Deer Project, the world's longest-running study of any population of land mammals, demonstrating that individual deer do have some say over whether it's sons or daughters they'll have, took many years and several steps of proof.
What we found was the mothers of the most successful males were large, dominant females. And they were the females that produced the males that monopolised the largest number of females. In contrast, the sons of smaller subordinate mothers tended to be extremely unsuccessful. They were commonly less likely to survive. They often died in the first 2 years of life. And if they did survive, they were seldom able successfully to monopolise large numbers of females.
Now, this is something I didn't expect to see. We've come down to the edge of a beach, and there are two deer just about 100 foot away from us, and they're both eating seaweed. Is that an important part of their diet?
Well, they do, in the wintertime, they do spend quite a lot of time when the tide starts going out on all the seaweed that's washed in on the high tides. And when they're down on the seaweed, they tend to get quite defensive of it. If they get a nice, choice piece of seaweed, they will try and keep other animals away from it or end up having a bit of interactions between individuals then.
So that, in a sense, brings out the dominance among the females.
It can be very subtle from just one hind looking at another hind and the ears going back and then, you know, that being enough, the head's up and the ears are back and it's enough for another hind to turn away or a younger individual to turn away. Ultimately, they can escalate right the way up to boxing each other when they're on their back legs and really fighting each other with the front legs, at which point the subordinate one will turn away. So obviously there's something very good in seaweed that is worth defending.
So will that actually mean then that the more dominant females get the pick of the best food, as it were?
Well, I think they probably do. I can understand in a way why they want to defend nice bits of it. If it's the middle of winter and it's the tastiest thing they've had for quite some time, then I would defend it too.
For large dominant females, their sons generate more grandchildren than their daughters, whereas for small subordinate females, their daughters generate more grandchildren than their sons. So what you'd expect on that basis, you'd expect large dominant mothers to produce a male bias sex ratio and small subordinate mothers to produce a female bias sex ratio. And when we looked at it back in the 1980s, relatively early in the study, that's exactly what we found. The top-ranking mothers were producing between 65 and 70% sons, and the bottom-ranking mothers were producing between 35 and 40% sons.
There's a good example of two hinds. One is Jay, she's a very dominant hind, and Shale. And Shale has female calves and will generally spend time away by herself. She doesn't like being part of the group. Then you have the likes of Jay. She's got a son from 2003, and she's a very big female in the group. Her presence is felt amongst the other animals in it.
Turning to how do mothers do it, the straightforward answer is we really don't know. It could be a consequence of differential conception of sons and daughters right back at the beginning of the conception stage, or it could be a consequence of differential implantation of male or female fetuses. Finally, it could in some cases be a consequence of differential mortality of female and male fetuses during the period of gestation.
The Trivers-Willard effect in this population of deer was at its strongest in the 1980s. But since then, the female's ability to influence their offspring's sex, depending on their rank in the herd, has been overridden as the total numbers of the animals in the population grew. These days, in some years, fewer sons are born to everyone in the hierarchy.
So what we're finding is that it's environmental effects that are now generating variation in the sex ratio, so that after years of high density, there are relatively small numbers of males produced. And after bad winters, there are relatively small numbers of males produced too.
Are they quite dramatic variations year from year, when the winters are particularly tough or the density of the population is particularly great and presumably coming in there is competition for food?
They're of the order of between 10 and 20%. So whether you call that a dramatic result, I don't know, but it's quite a substantial one. There are quite a wide variety of studies of human sex ratios have shown small fluctuations, typically in the range of 2 to 7%, whereas these fluctuations are certainly bigger than that.
So what of skewing the chances of a son or a daughter in us humans? We might be mammals, like red deer, but we don't have their mating system, in which only a few males get to breed with many females. However, factors like dominance and status and or the condition of mothers could be playing a part, according to some studies. Ruth Mace, an anthropologist at University College London, was in Ethiopia in the year 2000 when the south of that country was hit by a severe food shortage. As part of a study on nutrition, she looked at the birth statistics of about 300 women caught up in the crisis.
We thought it might be interesting to see whether the mother's nutritional state was correlated in any way with the sex of the baby that she had most recently produced. And we did, in fact, find that there was a significant effect, not a huge effect, but a statistically significant effect, that mothers that had higher body mass index, i.e. more body muscle, more body fat, and also larger arm circumference, were more likely to have had their most recent birth be male than female, and the converse of that.
Well, what was the size of that effect, say if you compared the most well-nourished, stronger women to the ones who were doing least well of all?
Most studies of this on humans have found either no effect or very small effect. So by human standards, it was quite a large effect in that for perhaps 100 to 115 in the higher body mass women.
So were the stronger women having proportionately more boys and the
yes.
women who were at the most malnourished end, they were having proportionally more girls? There was actually quite
yes.
a skewing.
Yeah, in most human populations there is a male bias at birth and male infants do have slightly higher early mortality. Therefore, by the age of sexual reproduction, most human populations are back to 1 to 1.
So how would you interpret what you saw then?
Well, we actually don't have any data on mechanisms, so it's only speculation. But a plausible hypothesis is that because males are more costly to raise to term, then it may just be more likely that mothers in the very early stages of pregnancy with a male are either using up more energy or anticipating using up more energy and therefore are more likely to reach some threshold at which they lose the baby, possibly even before the mother knows she's pregnant.
Whether this response is a means human mothers have evolved to improve their chances of more children from their own children is open to debate. Another researcher has an alternative theory which harks back to another aspect of the red deer and their sex ratio manipulation. According to Valerie Grant of the University of Auckland in New Zealand, dominance in personality is the underlying factor.
Dominant are defined as emotionally tough or psychologically tough. And dominance is a characteristic that human beings share with animals. And I came to notice that women who were a bit more dominant than others tended to have more boys. I did a series of tests of that over the years with groups of women in varying stages and found that there was indeed a statistically significant result in that the women who were more dominant than other women did in fact conceive and bear more sons.
So what are the chances then of the most dominant women having boys rather than girls?
It does seem to be on a gradated scale, and women who scored about 80% dominance on my test were about 80% more likely to conceive a son. There was quite a strong effect.
For most women in the broad middle, the chances of a boy or a girl are close to 50-50. Other researchers are intrigued by the findings, and even more so by the fact that Dr. Grant has gone on to find that the most dominant women also have the highest levels of the so-called male sex hormone, testosterone, in their blood. She's put up a tentative hypothesis for how this might be influencing whether mothers have girls or boys.
The link is between testosterone in the bloodstream and testosterone, which is at higher concentrations in the follicular fluid in which the ovum develops. So I'm wondering if perhaps the ovum is adapted each cycle according to whether it's developed in a medium with a lot of testosterone in it or only a little bit. And it may be that when it ovulates, it's already adapted, shall we say, to receive an X or a Y sperm, depending upon whether that mother is particularly suited at that time and in that place to raise a girl or a boy.
So if this is the case, then what would be the evolutionary advantage of pairing dominant mums with sons and less dominant ones with daughters?
I wonder whether dominant females aren't particularly suited to raising male offspring. And it may be that women in particular who have strongly dominant characters are particularly suited to raising boys.
Any theory which explained how and why individual parents are manipulating the odds over whether they have boys or girls might get a supportive boost if it could also account for why, at certain times, the ratio of boys to girls born changes across entire populations, something that happens towards the end and just after war.
The end of the war in Europe was officially announced by Mr. Churchill at 3 o'clock this afternoon in a broadcast from 10 Downing Street. He said, yesterday morning...
Censuses from around the latter ends of the Second and First World Wars show that significantly more boys than girls were born. One analysis of German birth statistics from the months after VE Day found 113.5 boys to every 100 girls. One explanation for the extra war baby boys includes another rather mysterious observation that the sex of an embryo appears to be influenced to some extent by when during the mother's menstrual cycle it was conceived. John Lazarus, an evolutionary psychologist at Newcastle University, suggests why that might be relevant to wartime.
When soldiers come back to their wives and lovers immediately after war, there's going to be an increase in the frequency of intercourse. If sexual intercourse increases in frequency, then fertilisation is likely to occur a little bit earlier in the woman's menstrual cycle. Fertilisations early in the menstrual cycle are more likely to result in a son, and those in the middle of the cycle are more likely to result in a girl.
Why would that be?
There are different hypotheses about this. One by William James is that it's the level of different hormones within the woman that is important in controlling the sex of the offspring. Why, we don't know.
Valerie Grant has another explanation, which features the testosterone at the core of her dominance hypothesis. But rather than dominance, it's all about stress in this case.
Testosterone in females rises under stress. It's quite different in males. In males, testosterone drops under stress. Testosterone levels rise during the very difficult conditions during wartime, and that women who would be just below, say, the level for conceiving a son in normal times, their testosterone would rise under the difficult conditions and make them more likely to conceive sons.
If there's one thing everyone agrees on, is that there's still a long way to go to make a coherent story out of all the data from the human studies. Some of them have found sex biasing under certain conditions, others haven't. There's also quite a number suggesting the circumstances of the father, not only the mother, can sway the chances of boys or girls.
For example, several have found that men towards the top of the social economic scale are more likely to father sons than daughters. But then, how might you explain that men employed as divers, test pilots, and sawmill workers tend towards daughters? John Lazarus agrees there's a lot to sort out, but he thinks it's credible that hormones can load the dice.
It's much more difficult when we move from other mammals to humans. We have simple things happening in humans like starving and being well fed, and these can produce gross effects. But as well as that, we're also socially very subtle organisms. And we know that our subtle psychologies can feed into our physiology through hormones. So we know there are ways in which our subtle psychological lives feed into our biology, and there may be quite subtle effects here from male status, having a good job, feeling of high status in one's local group. These quite subtle psychological effects could feed through into hormone levels and ultimately, and we don't know how yet, into the physiological processes that decide whether a male fetus or a female fetus is to survive a pregnancy.
The lives of most of us in the developed world are far removed from the ways of life of our hunter-gatherer ancestors. And it's under those circumstances the ability of one or both parents to modify the sex ratio of their families would have had its evolutionary advantage. Perhaps these days we're just seeing faint echoes of something very ancient. On the other hand, Sarah Erdy thinks it's possible this kind of pre-birth family engineering could often be an evolutionary disadvantage and best kept modest, given the diversity of the world's cultures and the unpredictability of human life.
If you think about humans and how variable our family systems are, and you think about human history, it would be quite dangerous, actually, to have any kind of fixed rule, mother in good condition, conceive more sons, simply because a mother would be wrong as often as she was right. As culture and ideologies change through time, I think it's possible that because human mating systems are so variable and so flexible, we may not be able to afford a fixed physiological rule the way an opossum or a red deer might be able to.